G'day, Tom Uren here, and in this episode of Between Two Nerds, the Gruck and I talk about how the information environment has really changed in a way that's making clandestine humint much, much harder. We start with the Gruck talking about how intelligence agencies haven't truly embraced OSINT and why that's a problem.
OSINT is a dirty word inside of, for example, like CIA or whatever places, like, because OSINT has traditionally been like you read the brochures and you skim through some magazines.
I wouldn't describe it as a dirty word, but I would call it a second class int.
Right. Like, you're not running agents. You're not using secret spy satellites. You know, you're not.
Yeah, that's right. Tunneling. Secret stuff's the good stuff.
Right. Like, everything that's cool is classified. That, like, we all know that. It's cool, classified, CC, obviously. If it was like open, it's worthless. Anyone could find that out. But I think because the information environment has changed, and it has changed so dramatically, so much stuff is now open that just wasn't before. And that legend of like, oh, I'm working as a journalist, that's the sort of thing where OSINT is actually going to penetrate that legend much faster than trying to do some classified, like, okay, we need to find out the university and recruit someone who's got access to, like, find out people close to the editor. And, like, you know, you could just use Facebook. Like, it's right there. It's open. And in a way, like, these databases that used to not exist are now not only do they exist, but they're searchable online from anywhere.
And if they're not searchable and online, they've been leaked.
Right. So I think that changes things in ways, like it cuts both ways, right? On the one hand, it gives you a lot more power to do things like uncover GRU agents, but it makes it a lot harder to be an agent yourself. Like, you can't have your officers doing things that you're used to doing. It, you know, as you were saying, you know, if you've got Vladimir who went to like this high school, majored in math and, you know, whatever, you can't make him a drama major all of a sudden and try and get him into somewhere else under that. It's just because his history, which is going to be not in things that you control anymore, right? Historically, the only way to find out about people was to go where they were and ask about them. It wasn't.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is you're arguing that the CIA's humint budget should be cut and it should all be put into OSINT. You know, cut your losses.
Yeah. They, you know what they need to do is just put people through the Bellingcat training course. That's it. That's the extent of it. Just fire everyone. Or, hypothetically, they could just hire a lot more people because they're going to need a large swath of backgrounds to have people who can go and be from various different things. So rather than having invented legends, just hire all of the possible legends. Right? And then you'll have your quiver will be full of people when you're like, all right, we need a 63-year-old homemaker who, you know, used to work for NASA and, like, you know, boom. All right, get Marjorie on the line.
Yeah, so that makes me think about the point of having deep cover operatives. And it seems like you want someone who can gradually work their way towards something that you don't think you can turn someone. Like, if you could just manipulate someone to give you those secrets who works there in the first place, well, you'd just do that, right? And so there's got to be a huge reason that you would invest so long. Some of these people have been undercover for years, right? If not a decade.
Well, like, the illegals program is a bit different than, it's traditional humint, but it's, the illegals program is meant to run for decades. Like, they should be able to retire with a pension in the place that they're notionally from. Like, that's sort of the idea. But it's, they recruit people without actually recruiting them. It's the befriending. It doesn't end with a contract and a salary like it's supposed to end with. Like, if the CIA recruits you, there's going to be a contract and they're going to be paying you monthly because that's the way that they operate. Like, if they don't do that, then the guy doesn't get the promotion for having done a recruitment. Like, it doesn't count. But the illegals program, that's not really the goal. It's, you know, part of it is getting people in there, but it's also recruiting people so that you can collect information on a friendly basis without the, you know, like, go and steal stuff, leave it in the dead drop, and you can pick it up in 4 hours, no sooner. You know, leave a bent nail on the windowsill, like, not that sort of thing, but it's like, hey, long time no see. So how's it going at work? You know, is General so-and-so still sick? Still hasn't taken on that new position in the Pacific? It's that sort of goal. And it looks, yeah, like those days might be over for real, but it makes me curious as well about, you know, how long can the people who, like, I work at the embassy, let's have coffee. Like, how long can the people who are supposedly just working for the Foreign Office continue to do that? Because now you can track their career a lot better as well.
Yeah.
You can go and see, like, when they went to school, were they doing, you know, law and politics and, you know, international relations? Are they getting their MA or their PhD in IR? Are they, you know, working? You can look, where are they working when they go home? Do they still have all this stuff? So there was an interesting thing I remember hearing from Halvar, how historically the German Secret Service, or whatever their spy agency is called, they had everyone undercover, like all of the analysts, all of the officers, you know, the secretary, like no one was upfront about it. But not too long ago, they stopped that. Now only, like, maintaining cover for all of these people is just too difficult.
Right.
So if you're a secretary, fine, you're a secretary at the Secret Service, you know, don't put it on Facebook, but we're not going to maintain a cover for you.
Yeah, well, here in Canberra, we have ASIO, which is the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, and it does counterintelligence and counterterrorism and that sort of thing. And last time I checked, they all operated undercover, where they work for a different government department. And so Canberra's a relatively small place. You know, you meet someone from there and it's like, well, do you really work for there or do you work for the other place? But the problem is that the buildings are actually located in a different place. And so one of the projects someone did when I was working at a think tank was they just went to the car park nearby and they fired up Tinder. So the ASIO people are not super secret. It's just that's the kind of default, right? They're not going to operate overseas and be subject to foreign intelligence services.
A little bit hush-hush, a little bit down low. Not...
Yeah, yeah. And it's actually illegal to out an ASIO person in Australia. So there's at least a historical sense that it was important. but to me, that's an illustration of how hard it is to, in practice, nowadays. I guess in times past, you could sit outside with a camera and try and photograph everyone as they drove into the building.
Right. That is the thing that they actually did. And that used to be like a counterintelligence thing to look for, is like, is that the same car over the last few weeks? Or like, is that one of a set of rotating cars?
Yeah. So the other funny thing is that the ASIO building used to be in a secure compound. So, you know, you could, and people did do this. They'd watch people going into the compound. And there was a number of other buildings in there. So, you know, you worked in the intelligence community. Nowadays, it's just all by itself. And across the road is just this massive complex of apartments and cafes. And the joke is that they're all rented by the MSS.
I was going to say, it's like, and there's this one little Chinese restaurant that has all of these weird delicacies that are impossible to find.
The food is really good and cheap.
Right, yeah, they're not really that friendly when you go in, but wow, the food, it's amazing. In terms of how cyber screws that stuff up, a friend of mine did this project where he got the geolocation, like the coordinates for like the NSA Fort Meade car park and at Langley and stuff like that, to just, you know, look at where people are. And then, as you know, you're not allowed to take your phone into these sort of things. So they all leave them in their car park. And then when they get out, the first thing they do is they're like,
just turn them
desperate.
On.
So they start, right? And they start tweeting. So he used the tweeters, like Twitter has a search by geolocation thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. So he would search and see who was tweeting from the car park. And it would be things at like 5:01, yo dog, who wants to get a beer? Right?
Yep.
And it was like...
I had a friend who was, like, there was a number of people working in defense who were extremely security conscious, and they would do things like have their phone set up to only switch on once they moved past a certain distance out of a kind of radius. But I can, like, even though there was a number of people, you can bet that they were like a tiny percentage of the people working in the building, because there's, you know, all sorts. And many people, even in that community, don't recognize the kind of security risks of turning on a phone.
Right. And the thing is, a bunch of them don't have security risks from that, right? Like, there's going to be analysts. So you'll have like a CIA analyst. There's like 10,000 of them. He's not leaving the country. You know, like he doesn't have access. Like the secret information he has is not like identities of agents or the specifics of like technological things. It's secrets of, you know, the wheat product of Belgium for, you know, whatever. But since he works at CIA, he's not really supposed to go like, yeah, I work at CIA. So he's going to be secret, but it's of the, like, I work for the government, not like...
Well, I mean, there's a counterintelligence risk, right? If people know that you work for that organization, you become a target. And taking a defense in depth approach, right? You may as well stop people trying to know.
Absolutely.
Stop the other side from knowing who you work for. That seems like a good idea. So I guess one thing is I don't know what to call it, but the telecommunications environment has changed, the sort of mobile phone thing, the fact that privacy and the way that your device leaks data is just a nightmare. Where it's not even possible to know what the security risks are for the average person.
The thing is, the security risks that you have now, even if they're changed, this is going to be a snapshot in time. Like, that data is going to exist anyway, right? So, for example, with the database for the border crossings, right? Even if they suddenly decided, you know, a year after she'd done the first...
Yep. So we're talking about the Belarus cyber partisans gave Bellingcat a database of border crossings, and Bellingcat used that database to basically identify a Russian deep cover spy.
Probably more than one, to be honest. Yeah.
Yeah, I would suspect, right?
Well, this is the other thing. They have a level of due diligence that they have to go through for reporting. So how many things did they find that they're 80% sure of?
Yeah.
But they can't go to print with it because they just don't have, you know, that nail, they don't have that final confirmation. They're pretty much positive, you know, like it's in the right passport range. All of the traffic is highly suspicious. It seems kind of weird that they have this strange backstory that doesn't really match up with reality as we know it. And, you know, there'd be all these indicators that scream this is an illegal, but no actual confirmation. There's no way Russia has had two illegals. This lady, the ICC guy, there's more. There has to be.
Definitely. Well, part of the Bellingcat story, and what amazed me, was that they had access to call data records. So the story they say is that they just buy them or get them from a leaked database, which seems plausible to me. But they actually, in the article, talk about how after they revealed that they knew about the passport numbers, that they subsequently got call data records from the head of the GRU to the head of the illegals program, plus a kind of spider web of, I presume, agents who they were ringing to say, time to come home.
Yeah.
But they also managed to combine that with all sorts of other data from leaked databases that kind of corroborated or confirmed their suspicions. So I think one of the very last pieces was they had Maria Adela, was her cover name, calling a particular GRU person from call data records.
Operator, I need a pickup. Yeah, so here's the thing that I know about Russia is that you might be aware that there's a lot of hackers in Russia. And while they're not supposed to hack things in Russia, that's not... Like, hacking tends to have a bit of an anti-authoritarian flair to it, a little bit of a flavor of not doing what you're told. So there is actually a huge amount of hacking that goes on inside of Russia, but it's a lot more underground than the ransomware, sort of the cybercrime economies right? Like you'll get like the actual black hats who are, you know, of the old style, like doing it for their curiosity. Those sort of people are the ones who end up with things like CDR databases you know, they trade with other people for other cool things.
Well, I did write about a group, I think it was called Rocket Hack, a Russian-based group that basically sold any kind of sensitive information you can imagine. All the kinds of data that we've talked about, call data records, passport databases, and it seemed that anything was on the table if you wanted to pay for it. So that at least seemed plausible to me.
I believe that. I don't think that Bellingcat is, I don't know, hacking Russian telecoms and, you know, exfiltrating. Where I was thinking about is like data enrichment, right? It's the ability to take these little pieces, like where you could take all these little bits of information from different places, put them together and get a much better picture. And just the amount of enrichment you could do now, particularly when you look at like buying stuff from data brokers who have, you know, if you have a phone, you've leaked all of this information that's now going to be sold, you know, and then if you are a state and you hack, you know, like China did when they hit the hotels and the airlines so that they could, you know, look at people who are flying out of Dulles and staying on like, and the Anthem insurance, you know, all of this sort of.
And combine it with the Office of Personnel Management. The
right. And
every single person with a clearance in the States. I suppose an interesting point there is that not being on Facebook isn't necessarily a protection, right? Because
that's worse, right?
Because that's kind of unusual. And so opting out of modern digital life is not a solution for a spy.
Right.
Because you kind of look at anyone of suspicion and you go, okay, here's all the people in the embassy. These five never carry a phone when they go out. Why would that be?
Right.
Because they're Luddites.
Right.
Or because they're the cultural attaché.
Right. And it's the same ones who don't have a Facebook. Right. And it's the same
exactly
the same guys who like sometimes take a 4-hour drive and then the next time we see them they're just at the market picking up vegetables. You know, and like
that's right. Yeah. Take a drive where they make a lot of left and right turns for no apparent reason. So yeah, that gets very tricky. There's also the leaked database and the digital footprint that we've spoken about. There's facial recognition, which makes it difficult to assume a new identity. They all make it difficult to assume a new identity, right?
Right. So a thing with the facial recognition. So on facial recognition, I remember I was reading an article in Wired from several years ago where they were looking at this thing of like, now when you cross a border, any country that you go into is going to have a camera that takes your picture when you are at the immigration desk. And that blew so many human sort of operations already. Like you can no longer, like if you travel to France on your France passport, you travel to Germany on your German passport, and like that was fine because, you know, the names were different. Or you could enter with one and leave with a different one. That's no longer possible because of these facial, because of the pictures that get taken and then get matched up. So what they were doing was they were red teaming, right? They would take people and they'd put them in with a full beard.
Yep.
And then when he would leave, he'd have only a mustache. They'd see, does he get flagged? And then, you know, he'd come in with a mustache and put on a full beard to leave. And like, does he get flagged? How much can you change before you get pulled aside? Like, what are the limits of physical appearance disguise that you could go through before getting flagged?
Yeah. So there are doppelgangers. There are people who actually look the same, even though they're totally unrelated. And my understanding is if you search any facial recognition database, you'll get people who look an awful lot like that person. And so then you're left with all the other signals, I guess, beyond the face. So I guess from a counterintelligence point of view, it just narrows down who you have to look at tremendously.
Well, that's a lot of the thing that you're trying to do most of the time in counter. And like, in CI stuff, you want to get like a short list that you can focus your attention on because people...
Yeah.
What was the thing? It's the difference between being on the radar and being under the microscope.
Mm.
Right? Like you can have a bunch of people on the radar. Like everyone at the embassy is suspicious. But that guy with no Facebook, profile, he doesn't carry a phone, he's under the microscope. That's that's sort of where you want to get, because that's like, this is a thing we've talked about before with the bureaucracy, and these are actual organizations. You have limited resources that you need to invest, and you want to make sure you're going after the most high,
the high value targets. Yeah.
You know what that reminds me though, is the Iranian hostage rescue from the 80s, where they were using the latex masks. So the CIA in the 80s, they had these full latex masks, the things that Hollywood does now, where you're literally someone else.
Like there was a Mission Impossible stuff.
Yes. Like they had those in the 80s. They still use them. You can buy custom ones online. You can get cheap ones for like $50. You can get like a proper custom one that literally changes who you are, that you can talk to someone like face to face and they don't notice, for a few thousand. Like it's affordable for someone with a decent job. It's well within budget for these things. So of course you can't live in a latex mask, right? Like it's that, and if you carry it into a country, that's going to be a bit weird.
right. But border crossings, I'm thinking of Total Recall now.
Right, like that.
So I suppose the other option is cosmetic surgery.
Right. Well, like
it seems like a bit drastic for perhaps for some missions, that's worth doing, perhaps.
Perhaps, but I don't know.
I don't even know how good that would be at avoiding facial recognition.
I don't think it would be that good.
Because like, you can't move your eyes around.
Right, like you can't change like where your eyes actually end. Like you can probably adjust whatever it is in simple fold, or there's things you could do, but you'd also have to be like within, this is one of the things that comes up a lot, is like you can do stuff that will fool a computer, but you have to fool a person as well. So with some of the like adversarial AI stuff, you can do things where you can like manipulate a photo, but you can't really do it in the real world to be the same thing. Yeah. So you can manipulate it. You can create it so like the system that the Tesla is using sees a stop sign when a human only sees like a blank wall or whatever. But then when you try and do it in context, it doesn't work because there's all that extra information that comes in as well. Similarly, when you do a thing like a face, you can do it so like the computer, like it can't see, like remember that crazy makeup they have where it's like defeats facial recognition by creating like, you know, razzle-dazzle.
Yeah, and I've seen ones where you just have little IR lights on your glasses that are meant to defeat facial recognition just by sort of...
Yeah, like just like by screening the camera.
Yeah, but like infrared, so to the human eye, there's nothing to see, but it defeats because a lot of those cameras are sensitive to IR.
Right, but then you're going to glow like a beacon as you walk through all the CCTV, and it, you know.
Yeah, it works once.
Right. So, like, I think this is the thing is security, like, we sometimes forget this in, like, the security industry. It's a combination of things, right? It's, like, technology, procedures, and personnel. You know, like, it's all of these things together. If you defeat the technology, but there's like a person on the other side going like, wow, the computer stopped working, I better go check. You know, it's not sufficient to just do one thing. And procedures as well, like there can be ways that you can use procedures to mitigate faulty technology. So you can get around,
So in the Bellingcat example, the faces that they compared Maria Adela to didn't match. So the face didn't put her under the microscope, but she was kind of in the second or third tier of faces that matched. And so it was a number of other data points that zeroed in on Olga Kolobova is her real name. And so there's an example where you can defeat one aspect, like facial recognition in this case, and whether they did that on purpose or not, I don't know, but probably not, I would guess, considering she was in place for maybe a decade or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
So I doubt that they were thinking about that at the time. And it was also absences in some of the databases. So this person was absent when Maria Adela, she was not in Moscow when Maria Adela was in Naples.
Yeah, well, like with the CI stuff, it's good to just think of a Venn diagram a lot of the times. Like you're just saying, like, you know, given this set of things and this set of things, what's the overlap? All right, let's look at those people.
Yeah.
Now let's add another set of like qualifiers. Okay, let's look at that. You know, you're trying to add all of these filters and things like not being present. You know, like, has Maria Adele ever been at two places at the same time? You know, she is Superman.
Yeah, and I guess to sort of sum up what we've been saying is that if you look at that Venn diagram, there's more and more circles that have been added over time. When you get Facebook, when you get databases that are stored, when you get mobile phone geolocation data and app data, and all these circles make it harder and harder to...
The space to operate gets smaller and smaller because all of these circles just keep cutting off operational techniques. So that as they shut things down, there's just less and less space. There's less wiggle room.
Yeah, so we're calling it here the death of Humint.
That's it. Fire everyone. CIA is over. Sorry, lads. You had a good one.
Yep, you had many good cocktail parties. Party's over. Thanks a lot, Grant.